Welcome to Side by Side, a podcast where I, Robert Kwong, take you inside conversations with artists, creatives, healers, and warriors taking the charge in their transformational story. Today's guest is activist, artist, and educational trainer and facilitator, Valerie Walker. In this conversation, we dive into a variety of topics, including the inspiration that is her mother, Rosemary Walker, the peaceful New York City march that she spearheaded on Juneteenth, 2020, called Break the Chains with Love, and different ways listeners can participate in advocacy across cultures, geography, and abilities. This year, Valerie and I are both artists in residence with the independent artist collective, The Keepsake House. We will be performing at different shows this year, and the next show will be this Thursday, February 16th, live at the Rockwood Music Hall. You can attend in person or watch us via live stream. So be sure to check the show notes to reserve your spot and support the artists. Thank you so much for taking some time out to connect with me, Valerie. I had the privilege of hearing some of your writing and storytelling at the end of last year, and I was just so, it stayed with me for so long, and I just wanted to reach out and connect with you. Yeah. So thank you.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Well, thank you for sharing that with such vulnerability, and it just left such an impression. So I thought, you know, as a place to start, maybe I will just inquire, starting at the beginning. Where did you grow up? And how would you describe your early life?
So I'm a born and bred New Yorker. I was born in the Bronx, up by 163rd Street. And it was a very, very multi-culti area. It was a generation where anybody, where the kids stayed out till the streetlights came back on. Mm-hmm. You know, and you might run back in the house and grab water or something like that, but it was like very much you survived for 8 hours during the day somehow, if you weren't in school or whatever. And we traveled in little packs and cliques, and anybody could be your mother on the block that saw you doing wrong. But because it was so multi-culti, some of that information came to you in different languages. You know, like, ojalá que mira, mm-hmm. ven aquí, or mi lord child, I'ma smack you, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, so there were Jewish people, it was a really vibrant community. And then my mother told me and my sisters growing up that education was really all that mattered, because that was the only thing they couldn't take away from me. And of course, by they, she means, you know, sort of white supremacy in generalized terms, but anybody who would come for you, to deny you, to, because that's the legacy. You know, I was raised very much with that sense of, you were brown. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to work twice as hard. You have to expect half as much, even with that effort. So I was raised very much in like, you sort of make your destiny. You push where you can, and an implicit, like, don't be wary that you can have more, but be wary of wanting more. Mm. You know, like you can finesse it. I'm not telling you you're limited to this life. I'm telling you, this is your life. You can make what of it, what you want, can understand. And so I did, from a very young age. I was very precocious. I was an early reader in Head Start, which is a phenomenal program. At least it was a phenomenal program then. I had a difficult time with nap time. And so I made an agreement with my teachers that as long as I laid down when the other kids laid down, if I was awake, you know, when they all fell asleep, I could then get up and go to one of the centers and read or play, sometimes get an extra snack. I was always fascinated by information and more information. And I felt like it made me more. Mm-hmm. And then we moved to Staten Island when I was about 8, because my oldest sister got beat up and my mother was just not about that violence, and she was very much about trying to make a better way. And we were one of the first Black families to desegregate Staten Island. And we all there were like three family Black families. And they must have done some kind of ad campaign to do it, like recruitment or whatever, but I was too young to even absorb it, if that were true. But we all lived in the same building, all three Black families, the same apartment building. And then interestingly enough, my world turned very Black and white. It went from all this vibrant color to Black and white. And I'm Black. I didn't mind the Blackness. I love the Black. The Black part was regular, but it felt small. It was only contained within my house, because as soon as I went out of my house, it was a very different environment.
Yeah.
I remember in middle school, one of my first weeks in middle school, two white girls followed me home. I lived about 3/4 of a mile, like just shy of busing distance, but enough to make you be like, dang, that's a long walk. And after school one day, they just followed me home, talking about me the entire time. They called me the N-word, they called me nigga, and they got emboldened the longer I did nothing. You know what I'm saying? Like, I just kept walking, feeling those words and those sentiments and the cusses hitting me in my back, and I just took it and I kept walking. Because I knew, even if I turned to confront it, in this situation and this new Staten Island reality, I am nothing but wrong. And the more I do, the more wrong I'll be. Mm-hmm. So I just kept walking. And luckily enough, we turn, they don't know where I live. So I turn onto my block. And then I'm just talking about, like, where's this bitch even going? She's so confused. She don't even know where she lives. And I'm getting within like feet of my house. And my older sister happened to be on the porch. Actually, both my older sisters happened to be, we had this wraparound porch and they happened to be outside. And they heard, because they were so loud, they were, honey, they were having their own like little nigga lynching party. You know what I'm saying? They was fueling themselves up. They was having a good time. And so they were loud. And so they could be heard before we got to my house. And the middle sister, who's never climbed a tree before in her life, hopped off the ledge of the porch, jumped into the closest tree, and Jimmy rigged herself down on the ground within moments. And my other sister, older sister, had taken the stairs, and they both came down. And then there was a confrontation, which I still didn't even take part in. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? My older sisters just gave them the dozens, and there might've been a little bit of, you know, hands being thrown. And then it was briefly over and we went inside. And I didn't participate in that part either, mm-hmm. right? I was just sort of stunned by that. But even though that was kind of a thread all throughout, like let's call it a ribbon, not a thread. You could see it.
Yeah.
How do I say this? God gave me charm. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm trying to figure out a way to put that. Like, I have always been able to talk my way into or out of a whole lot of things. And I present well to parents, well-spoken, even as I, like, if a parent said to me, you're so well-spoken, I would say to them, for what? Why would you expect me not to be? Mm-hmm. Is education not valued in your home? Because it sure is in mine.
Right.
But even then, I don't know, for some reason, those white people, they liked being chastised by me. It's like, they were just like, oh, okay. For a long time, I felt like this sort of fraudulent Black girl, because the things that I was told as my beginning instruction were not turning out to be true. Like, I was not limited. You know what I mean? Like, I was the lead in the school plays and even in these white towns. And actually, when I was in high school and I got the lead in the school musical, the male lead was also Black, oddly. A very talented guy named Sheldon. But then pretty immediately, Sheldon quit because his family moved to another borough. So I immediately... The understudy was this white guy, Brian, still a friend to this day. But I knew they weren't going to keep me cast against romantic lead white blonde hair Brian? Is that not what they have in that? So I even went to the gym teacher who was the theater director also. And I was just like, look, I understand that you have to recast. And she was like, what are you talking about? And I was like, well, because I'm black and Brian's white and this is Staten Island. Like, I get it. Like, you know, and I just, it's easier for me to give it up than for you to take it away. Mm-hmm. And she was like, and she came over to me and I was really like trying not to cry because I really wanted this role, but I, you know, that was my level of acceptance of this reality. Mm. And she came over to me and she was shorter than me. And she just reached her hand up and she like pushed my chin up in the air. And she said, don't do that. Do not do that. She said, I can't change the world. And I'm not going to say that it isn't just how it is, but you never make it easier. And I was like, not this little white woman showing me how to be black. Okay. 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 You know what I'm saying? Yeah. That's when I knew my shit was so reckless that a white person was to tell me, no, girl, that's not how you do that shit. And I was like, yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. So, you know, like the only thing I would say that, like, I don't think I could have been the first female president because, you know, I discovered weed in college and I definitely inhaled and inhaled again with witnesses. But I said no to a great many things in my journey as a proud Black woman because they came too easily to me. And I thought I'm supposed to suffer.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, this is not supposed to be my way. And my mother always told me, I was raised with that adage of like, if it comes too easy, it's from the devil. Or like,
wow.
Then not. Mm. You know, like, be careful what you accept. There's a debt that will and must be paid. You don't know what people gonna ask for. So I'm like, raised, I said no to a lot of things. Now I look back, I'm like, damn, I could have been a CEO of some shit right now.
We'll talk about the power of story, right? The story that we have about ourselves and who we are and what we're capable of and who likes us and who doesn't. And it's so funny speaking about your mother. I know that you attribute your imagination and the way that you value storytelling and story to your mother, Rosemary Walker.
You just said my mama's name.
Yes.
Oh my God, oh. I will cry. You just said my mama's name. That is so lovely. Thank you.
It's a beautiful name. And I heard the story that you shared a little bit about your mom. It wasn't with a moth, but it was in a different platform. I hope I'll be sure to link it in the show notes. But the reason I bring this up is that you attribute so much of your creativity and your self-expression to your mother. Why is it important for you to share and honor stories about your mother and to use your voice in that way?
Stories last in a way that photos don't, in a way that moments don't. And I loved and love my mother. And she was beautiful, kind, complicated, loving, hilarious, and just had a whole hell of a lot of gumption. And she had an aesthetic. And I didn't, she had an aesthetic that was different for what was going on. Mm. People looked to her for like, what was she gonna wear? Or how she had decorated her home. She had a super green thumb. She had this ability to just make living things better. Wow. You know what I mean? Yeah. She gave the best hugs. We had a room, a half room in one of the houses we lived in that I thought was green because of all the plants in there until we moved out and realized that it was eggshell. Like in my memory, the whole room was green like this. It felt jungle. It was so lush with foliage because she had a thing about people brought their plants to her that were dying. She would turn it around. You know what I mean? People came with their hearts that were broken. She would help mend them. She just had, she would do Christmas time relief work at Macy's. And she was so good at gift wrapping that they elevated her to by appointment. You know what I mean? Yeah. So like she was gift wrapping for the 1%. So she was she made life more beautiful. You know what I mean? She had this way about her. She could cook. Anything you yearned for, she could provide it in some way. She was really, and shared herself. But she didn't have a lot of healthy boundaries. And so, and most people are much more selfish and stingy than they are generous, sadly. And she got hurt a lot. And so she also had experienced a great deal of pain, which I got to see, you know, like she was not a woman who held back her feeling in a way that I feel proud of, because I call a spade a spade. I call joy joy, and I call you somebody who need to get the hell out my face in that moment, because I'm not going to take it with me. Because when I turn the corner, joy might be right around the corner, and I don't want to meet that heifer with an angry face. So I got to let it go now. And that's through the legacy of her, because there's no shame in feeling. There's no shame in feeling. What you do with the feeling is different. So I got to see my mother as we were best friends. Like when I say she inspired my creativity, I remember one time we came from in the Staten Island Strip Mall. We'd gone to see Yentl in the movie theater, a matinee. And I have a good ear, so I could sing most of the songs before they were done. You know what I mean? I could get the full refrain and da 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 da. So when we were, and it's a musical with Barbra Streisand. So when we, who was a singer that I listened to in my home a lot. So when we left the theater, it was an empty sidewalk. Like nobody was really about and whatever. And it sort of just looked like this amazing runway in my mind. So I just broke out into, you know, Papa, can you hear me, Papa? And singing the song, and I am doing my thing. And I was like, is my mother gonna yell at me? Because, you know, when people can see you, you want to comport yourself in a certain way. But child, my mother passed me. Papa, can you find me? Like she was singing, you know what I mean? And I was like, wow, that's where I get this from.
Right. She gave you permission.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's where I get, yes, permission, yes. My mother was all about giving people permission to be themselves. But I think it cost her a lot. And she, you know what I mean? And she remembered you through your stories. Like if you felt heart sick, like she didn't believe in taking things that hurt you and putting them away in a box and avoiding them. She was like, let's open it. Let's get into it. Let's give it air, breath, and room till you get to the point of why it was okay to have had that moment. Why it was okay to still maybe want that person to be your friend. You know what I mean? She was very much like, let's not stew it. Let's do it.
Right.
So remembering her is the way I honor.
Right.
In fact, one of my big dreams after she passed was like, I want to be somewhere on a stage in front of a mic and talk about my mom. And I thought it would be like some acceptance speech or something, because that was the only thing space I knew of. I didn't know of storytelling. And so when I told that story at the Moth Grand Slam about my mom, that was just like inside I was falling apart. But it was really momentous and wonderful.
Yeah. It's so joyous to see people expressing themselves through different mediums. You use your voice, you use your storytelling. You're also quite the visual artist. Has that always been a part of your life? Just making sure there's room for that, you know, because as you get older, often, especially if you're just working on career and whatnot, very understandable, but these spaces can become smaller. And yet it seems to be a very vibrant part of your life in all mediums.
It is. I mean, I think anybody who knows me would say that I live pretty spherically, because I do believe things are connected, and I'm making art all the time. Like I feel bad because I feel like I give my friends so much crap that I make. They're just like, leave me alone. It's not my birthday. Leave me alone. Stop buying popsicle sticks. But I always have had the desire to create. I've always been very visual. I was dyslexic at a time before we knew about dyslexia. And so images were easier to grasp meaning from, because words, the order of those words and the meaning, you could get it totally different. It was interesting because even though education was important earlier on in school, I realized there was something wrong with me. You know, I'd raise my hand to answer the question and maybe the teacher call on somebody else. And oh my God, so thank God she did, because the answer they gave that was right wasn't even the answer I was thinking of. So I learned sort of through that happening enough times I was like, okay, girl, you gotta read things three times. Two times of confirmation, that's gonna be the truth. So I really like tried to develop a way to manage my own issues, but the picture was really how, like when I close my eyes, it's a movie screen.
Right.
And so when I write, I'm new to writing. I discovered the moth or storytelling right before COVID, maybe like 6 months before COVID, a friend recommended it to me. I was like, I'm hooked. I love this. This is awesome. Like you can lift people through this. You can help people work some shit out. You can make them feel seen. Like, this is just beautiful. And it's free. It don't really cost you anything to produce it, but the impact. Mm-hmm. Woo! I was like, I'm in. I'm on it. And I love the fact that after I watched it a little bit, I'm a theater person. I love performance. And I went, the first time I went, the person I thought would win, because she performed her story. Damn! Did not win. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did not win. And I understood that it was the real, the connection to the real in yourself and the real in others, that was really what made it so impactful. All this other, you know, like you can act it, but you have to do it with your voice.
Right.
And it, you know, it has to come from a real place, but you can't Meryl Streep it.
Right.
Kind of thing.
Right.
So that's what I also appreciated, because it felt like this is a space where you have to be you and willing to be seen, you know? And there are not enough Black people who are, right, who feel safe enough.
Right.
And because, like I said, I'm a little bit charming, so some of them doors have not been closed to me. Then I go over to the side and I open up a window and I'm like, Keisha, you coming?
Exactly. Amen to the charm. You know?
Like, literally, there was a girl, we were two Black girls in a mostly white space, and we would, you know, we had an affinity for each other and hung out and whatever. And we would do extra credit projects in school, right? So we would write an extra report about Abraham Lincoln or this or that, or in this science thing, talk about this science project. And because I was visual, and you know, Shanna was, she was like type A theist. So she would do most of the writing. And I would do the cover and I would edit it and I would add to it. But the core was her. Do you know, hand to God, every single time, if she said got an 85, I got a 90 for the same shit that we handed in together. It was just like that kind of like, oh, why is this happening? Mm-hmm. This shouldn't be happening.
And yet, you know, here you are using that talent that you've cultivated towards work for your advocacy, where you have to know how to use your voice and be brave about it and have to put up with public perception and all of it. And most recently, you did share a story about how you spearheaded and led a protest in New York City. It won't be as detailed and illustrious as the way you told it, but could you quickly capture some of the details leading up to the protest and what it meant for you?
So George Floyd was murdered. We were inundated with the images from that. It was branded on behind my eyelids. That was the movie I saw. It was during a time of lockdown, even though people were protesting in the street and being violated by police. I was so angry. I was so angry. I was afraid to go outside because I was scared I wouldn't make it back. I was scared that somebody white would accuse me of something and I would lose my mind and I would smite them and cops would shoot first and ask questions later. And it was hard. And then a friend, my best friend from third grade, her husband texted me. He's a pastor. And he said, he was just checking in on me. He said, I can walk outside and turn this off, but I know that you can't. Are you okay? And I was like, it was such a, and he's a pastor. And he also said, it was such a loving thing for him to do. And he's a pastor. He also said that he is uncertain how to guide his flock. And I was like, yo, that's deep as hell. Y'all have all these words in the Bible, the Torah, whatever good book you use, y'all have all these words. But if you don't have any words for this, this tells me that this is not supposed to be happening. You know what I'm saying? God couldn't imagine this. You know what I'm saying? So I was like, my mother always said, if it doesn't work, throw some love at it. If like you're not happy with something, try to change your perspective, throw some love at it. If you cooking something and it doesn't taste right, throw some love at it. Mm. And so I understood that my rage and my anger, as powerful as it can make you feel, it was imploding me this time. I wasn't active. I was fucked, you know? And so leaning on the love that I always feel I've had so much of, that's what I think some of that charm is, you know, is love. I suddenly felt different. I suddenly felt more enabled. And so I told him to preach to them love, because that's what we have to have for each other, because that's the only thing that's going to hold us down. And I thought, love, love. Okay, I can love. I'm pretty good. I've loved, you know, friends into enemies, back into friends. Like, I can love. I know what long-term love looks like. I know what sacrificing for love looks like. I can love. How can I do this? And so I said, I want to have a march. I put it out on Facebook. I thought me and 50 of my friends would have this very small, localized, mass kind of situation, and it would feel good. We'd make a joyful noise, and it would feel good. The sister of my third grade best friend was the first person to reply. She lives outside of New York, and she was like, Valerie, I will march with you. And I was like, damn you, Christine, I gotta have a fucking march. So I utilized, okay, what do I know for marches? What are we gonna do? Okay, I need marshals, I need this, I need that. And so I made a list. But then I made a list that was like my mommy list. Okay, so I know what I need to do. I have a march. How I'm gonna have a march that my mama would be proud of. I need balloons. Mm. I need this. Like, how are we gonna make this cute? So I made signs that were love signs. I'm a lesbian, so some of the signs were like, dykes love Black people. You know what I mean? All colors are good colors, like whatever, da 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 da. And I made extras so that if somebody had a hating sign, I could trade it out, because this is a love march. It's called Break the Chains with Love. And the love message just took off. Like, my Facebook invite was shared a ridiculous amount of times. It was sort of crazy. Like, people would come in, and like, friends from old protesting days contacting me. One woman trained my marshals. Another person helped me write this sort of manifesto of sorts. And it really, the Dyke March committee, because they weren't doing a Dyke March that year because of COVID, they were like, we have extra monies and resources. Any way that we can help you. And they helped me amplify my message. They donated some of their press opportunities about not having a Dyke March. And then they segued into my march. They helped provide marshals. It was super dope. A vendor came through and donated masks that say Black Lives Matter. So all the marshals could look uniform. It was beautiful. And then a friend called me and said, girl, turn on NPR. And I was like, she's like, I think they talk about your mark. And I was like, girl, what are the call signs for NPR? I don't, you know, so she told me and turned it on. They were, the woman, whoever was speaking was just saying at that point, it's a masked event, because wearing masks is another way that we show our love for each other, which was a direct quote from my manifesto. So I was like, oh my God, this shit's on NPR. I gotta get. So I also got lollipops, because my mom told me, anytime you ask somebody to do something hard, you should temper it with something sweet. So I got like 300 lollipops, right? I'm thinking, I'm balling. Girl, I went back, got 1,000 more lollipops.
Right.
Needed more than that, because when we got the drummers donated their time and came, Focal Azul, whoo. People who had no intention of marching, didn't even know what my march was about, was like, yo, I'm following them drums anywhere. Like 7,000 people marched across the bridge. It was crazy. It was insane. It was one of the best things ever. You know, one of the things in terms of these protests and things, you should not work with the police. You don't work with the police. However, most of the people that have ever said that in that sort of position of power have been white. But I was a Black woman who was responsible for the safety of 7,000 people of varying colors, mm-hmm. ages, and ability. And I took that responsibility very seriously. So I'm gonna work with whoever the fuck wanna work with me. Mm-hmm. So when the cops came over, they said, okay, can you tell us your path? And I said, I don't wanna reveal that information. They were like, well, is there any parts that's dangerous? And I said, there's one part where we'll be walking into oncoming traffic. However, the sheer number of us will be, that will make you safe. And they've said, well, what if we have a path that you could walk that risks nothing? Would you be willing? And I was like, yes. So we took the path past the precinct and they like sort of led the fray, whatever. And then we got to the bridge. We intended to take the passenger side, but there were too many people. And then the people that came to me initially for the cops were Black, two Black women. I was like, y'all trying to play a sister with two other sisters. This is some bullshit, mm-hmm. But okay, I'll play along. But when we got to the bridge, it was a white captain that came to me. Hello, sir, how can I help you? And he was like, well, what do you want to do? And I said, we were going to take the passenger path, but there's a lot of us. And I can see there are cops, both in the middle and at the end. I have no idea what those cops are doing there. I have no idea what they intend to do once we get there. So I'm not trying to take that path. There's enough of us that we're going to take the road. And he was like, so cars would have to stop. And he was like, okay, well, I'm gonna, you know, we'll help, blah, 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 blah. We'll stop the traffic. But do you promise to get there as fast as possible? Yeah, okay, sure. And then we took the bridge and then we got across. And then I was by the African burial ground monument in Manhattan. And I started my moment of silence. And the people in the front were like, talking on walkie-talkies, and they were like, girl, you can't start the moment of silence. People aren't across the bridge yet, all the way. Like, it was crazy. And then it was like, how are you going to brook a moment of silence with this many people? And I knew that I didn't have the capacity and strength to do that. I had sort of pushed everything I had in me to have this to get up to here. And this young, non-binary person used every bit of their youth and vitality and might check 7,000 people into silence. I can't even describe to you what that looked like. She just puffed herself up and just kept, it was incredible. It was everything. It was the greatest gift. And we had our moment of silence. I knew my mother could see it. I knew Malcolm could see it. I knew Martin could see it. I knew anybody Black who had passed related in any way to white supremacy, and that's all of them, could have this moment that all of these people, the majority of them were not of color, mm-hmm. were standing there in homage to them and their humanity. It was just everything.
I mean, you never forget the tragedy that prompted it. And yet, you know, hearing you describe the collective energy and collective action, it sounds like that kind of experience will definitely make you believe in love also, you know. As we're speaking now, I'm going to place it in time. We are in the aftermath of the murder of Tyree Nichols and in the aftermath of gun violence at the Lunar New Year Monterey Park shooting and more. My general question to you as someone with all this experience, how do you balance both the urge to need to process your emotions, the trauma, and to replenish your energy, and also the urge for participation and to take action? I mean, just on a personal basis, how do you try to strike that balance as a human?
First, I try to be thoughtful and intentional. I only have so much energy, right? So right. I can no longer do everything. And so I try to act more intentionally. I think what we see happening now is part of what I knew would be the pendulum swing to BLM, you know, and sort of the heights of sort of equity or consciousness of equity and privilege that we had reached with the saturation of information and people feeling pressed upon to be better, that it would swing back very, very far and would be very, very hard for the same people. And somebody said to me just recently about Tyree Nichols' situation that, do you feel any kind of way because this is a white person? Do you feel any kind of way because the cops were Black in this instance? And I said, no. And I said, because that wasn't five Black men who beat that Black man to death. Those were five cops who beat that Black man to death. And the policing system in this country was based and functionalized around a racist premise. The first cops were people who were there to corral and control lenient and indigent niggas who would just free Black men that nobody would hire, or women or people that nobody would hire, who were just living their lives. So our policing system is inherently racist. It's guided by that doctrine. So if you are a cop, you must pass whatever testing you need in order to be part of that Klan. Okay, so you got to bring your, and imagine the dichotomy of that and the fractures that could cause in your sense of identity, your sense of reason, your sense of humanity. So no, yeah, being a cop is bad for anybody of any color. That's what I say. You know what I mean? So it's been very interesting. It'll be very interesting to pay attention to what happens with legally with the situation and compare and contrast. I'm all about throwing the love. I'm just not sure who the love needs to be thrown at right now. But I do know that the outrage and the sense of injustice in the situation is just as valid, no matter the colors.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I could speak with you for so long.
I know, and you have the best voice ever.
Thank you.
Like, I'm like, oh, you read me to sleep at night? Like, that's just so nice.
Well, right back at you. Thank you so much, Valerie. Is there anything else that you want to leave people with? And also, maybe as a follow-up, if people want to pay more attention to these type of organizations and these ways of contributing to protests, to where they can just engage in any type of way, if you have any sort of recommendations, that's always welcome. But any messages you have before we conclude?
So in terms of what to do, where to do it, I would say start locally. Whatever it is, you want to sort of remove the barriers that you personally have, that which is why you haven't done it already, to right. do it. So if travel is a problem, then do something local. If you're uncomfortable working with this community, then start with a community that you do care about. And, you know, don't start something, go to a place where people are already congregating. I think it's really important to, you know, get onto those sites that tell you where different things are in your community. It's easily Googleable, yes. So I'm not even gonna give that airtime. That's what I would say. And I would say there's so many things that you can do. To say that there you feel uncomfortable writing a letter, being part of a letter campaign or a postcard campaign is sticking a stamp. Come on, stop playing yourself. If you are wondering why you should, because I would do it for you, right? And this is all about love. It doesn't show me love when you sit down when I'm standing, right? So at the very least, stand behind me. So when they knock me back, I got something soft to fall into, but I hope you stand next to me. And there's some days you really should stand in front. You really should stand in front. So in any way that you're compelled, do something. Even draw a picture. Little kids can do it. Like, talk about an issue in your classroom. There's no age limit to being an activist. An activist is somebody who speaks their mind, who yes. speaks their truth. Good activists are compelling at it. So smile when you tell them, you know? And I would just leave people with, COVID hurt everybody in some way. Some people attain their highest best self, and that's beautiful. But there was some hurt even along that way. We are all a little needy, right? We're all a little needy in some way. Mm-hmm. So I'm gonna ask everybody to stretch their capacity to give 10 cents to somebody in a cup, more than 10 cents, but you know, say some money to somebody in a cup. If there's a parent who has two irate children in that moment, maybe volunteer to calm one of them. Elderly person getting off or on the bus and they're unsteady, reach out your hand. Just give. You see somebody struggling to buy eggs, which are super expensive right now, and you balling with egg money,
right.
Throw it down. Don't even, just walk past and throw a 10. You know what I'm saying? Like, ball with giving. Be a yeah. pimp of giving.
I'm all misty eyed and you just cracked me up. thank you so much, Valerie. This is such an amazing conversation.
Enjoy the rest of your day, and I love you.
Thank you for tuning in. If you'd like to connect with me about the podcast or about my services, you can find me on Instagram at Robert Kwong Home, or you can find me through my coaching website at www.robertkwangcoaching.com.